Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition, available April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
MPPs are back in person at Queen's Park today for the first time this year, and their hands are going to be plenty full with myriad issues to pursue. COVID variants are looming over the province, and there are still disputes over paid sick days, vaccine rollouts, March break, and much more. We'll get into all of that on this Tuesday, February 16th, 2021, so let's get to it. JMM, the politicians are actually physically back at Queen's Park today. At the risk of using a bad pun, what's on the agenda?
You couldn't help yourself, could you?
Couldn't help myself, no.
So MPPs have been recessed since December, and obviously a lot has happened. There's a lot to discuss. Most immediately, I think the government's lockdown and the stay-at-home order that will have mostly expired by the time MPPs actually get to their seats this morning. I spoke with Government House Leader Paul Calandra last week. Some of the issues that Calandra named were, it may go without saying, but maybe it shouldn't, that COVID is really going to be everybody's top of mind for the next little while, certainly until vaccinations really kick into high gear. But there are other priorities. That includes everything from the environment and economic development in the north to some thinking around the government about how the pandemic has changed the way the government operates and whether some of those things might be made permanent. This is what Mr. Calandra said to me last week.
We're going to start to look at what we have learned during COVID and how we can take some of the things that may have benefited us during COVID, if I can say that. And move the agenda forward. I know, for instance, on the justice legislation, we've been able to reform the justice system quicker than we could have ever thought mm-hmm. to make it easier for people to access. And now we're going to be bringing forward legislation that allows us to capitalize on that.
That includes thinking a lot about how changes that the government has made during the pandemic could be made more permanent. And I think one of the best examples of this, and I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, is the court system in Ontario. any reporter who's ever had to deal with Ontario's courts could tell you that they are tradition-minded, let's say, and they have made really radical changes over the last year in order to continue the administration of justice in the province while also trying to keep people safe. And that has, of course, included a lot of Zoom courts. I don't think there's a Canadian case of anybody looking like a cat in court, but I'm sure we will get theirs too.
I wondered if you were going to get to use that line or if I was going to jump in with it first. So well done.
So there are a lot of issues that the government is thinking about in terms of the way that the pandemic maybe has, I don't want to say benefited the government, but the way that the government has sort of rolled with the punches and how some of those things might be made permanent. I do also know that the New Democrats will be trying to bring Peggy Sattler's paid sick leave bill to a second reading debate as soon as they're able. This is a bill that Peggy Sattler, who is now going to be the NDP House Leader, she introduced that back in December, and this would change the legal rights that workers have in Ontario. Currently, you can have unpaid sick leave for COVID in Ontario, but you can't get paid sick leave. And this is something that the opposition parties and many medical experts have said is really necessary going forward. The NDP can push that forward in the schedule using certain procedural moves. But when I spoke with Calandra, he certainly didn't suggest that the government has changed their own opposition on this.
Well, full disclosure here, we are obviously recording this before the first question period has taken place. But I suspect one of the issues that's going to be brought up is the province's decision to lift the stay-at-home order in parts of Ontario. The government's so-called science table last Thursday said keeping that stay-at-home order in place would help the fight against COVID-19. And I thought you summarized a lot of people's reaction very nicely to that in a question to one of the co-chairs of the science table. So let's hear that clip now.
I confess, Dr. Brown, I'm a bit confused by this presentation. You say that sticking with the stay-home order will help, but the stay-at-home order is ending almost everywhere in Ontario on Tuesday. You say that RT needs to be below 0.7, and we have never actually achieved that, and we're about to, if not reopen, we're going to reduce a lot of the public health measures. And those public health measures, as you say, as they are lifted, cases could rise dramatically. Am I missing something here, or is this presentation actually predicting a disaster?
No, I don't think you're missing anything. The cases will likely rise given the variants of concern. The need to keep that R down is really, really critical. But there are a number of things that need to be weighed in making these decisions.
McGrath, I got to hand it to you. I know you like to play the nerd, but you actually get to the heart of the matter, and that was a very well put question, so well done. Now, if the modeling of future infection is supposed to be forming the basis of the government's decision making, well, what's going on here then?
It's confusing. You heard me say it in that question. I really was confused. It's not an act. But I think you can hang a lot of this on the last few words that Dr. Brown said in that clip, that there's a number of different factors that need to be weighed here. The scientific advice that the government is getting is just one part of the debate that is going on. There's the science table, there's the public health measures table, which is a different, effectively a committee that makes its recommendations to the government. And then all of these recommendations go to cabinet, where, of course, the person really making the decisions is Premier Doug Ford. And, you know, he is clearly hearing from lots of people that they want the stay-at-home order to end. People are getting to the end of their rope. It has been a pretty hard winter, and it's still only February. And, you know, it is properly the government's role to balance the medical advice that they're getting with what they think is politically sustainable. What is confusing about the current moment is that you've really got the scientific experts warning in very stark terms that the hospital system could be at risk again only weeks from now, and we don't really know yet what the government is going to do to offset the increased risks that come from ending that stay-at-home order and moving more regions out of the lockdown into the old color-coded regional framework. You know, all of these things are going to make life a bit riskier in Ontario than it has been. And the government hasn't yet really given us a good sense of what new measures it's taking to offset those risks.
I do want to reemphasize one of the points you just made, because it's worth remembering that the science table is only supposed to take the science into account. Now, Premier Ford, on the other hand, has to take science into account, the politics of the moment into account, the art of what's possible into account, having a feel for what the public will go along with and what he thinks they won't go along with. Fair to say here that this is all somewhat a much more complicated set of calculations than at first blush?
It absolutely is. And I think the science table, some of the participants in the science table have been criticized, I think unfairly, but that's a whole other topic. They have been criticized for maybe, you know, getting outside of their lane and making policy advice when they should stick to scientific description. And I think, you know, it's not that cut and dry. The scientists can look at, for example, what kinds of measures have worked in other countries, right? Everybody is going through this right now. And so we can say with maybe not perfect precision, but with some idea what is effective against COVID, what was effective against the original variant, what is effective against the new, more, you know, concerning variants. And so the science is inevitably going to get pulled into questions of politics and policy. And I think you can see both in the briefings that Dr. Brown has given and other briefings that we've had, they can make their recommendations to government, but there's no guarantee that the government will follow them. And, you know, if you're a believer in robust democratic debate, it's not even clear that the government should follow absolutely every piece of advice that they get from the scientists.
There you go. And we should just say that Dr. Brown that you've referenced a couple of times is Dr. Adelstein Brown, Stainy Brown, they call him. He's from U of T Public Health. Something that has come up previously in question period. Let's move on and talk numbers now. The government got some flack from the opposition this past week over the fact that the allegation was that the government was sitting on billions upon billions of COVID-19 contingency fund dollars from the federal government. But there were dueling news conferences towards the end of last week from both the Minister of Finance, Peter Bethlen-Falvey, and the opposition parties about whether that was, in fact, the case. So help us out here. What's the 411 there?
The government released the third quarter finances last week, and this is a normal part of the fiscal cycle, how the government spends money through the year. And it basically just updates the public on how much the government has spent this far in the year versus the plans it made earlier in the year. So, I mean, basic fact here that in government, the fiscal year starts on April 1st and it ends on March 31st. And so we are basically heading into the tail end of the fiscal year. And we got a background briefing from nonpartisan staff in the finance ministry. And we were told that contrary to the allegations that have been made by both opposition parties and people outside of government, basically all of the special contingency funds that the government had set up earlier in the year to spend COVID money have effectively been emptied, or they have been allocated and are on their way to being spent. And this was another sort of specific accusation that had been made against the government. The federal money that had come in from the Liberal government of Justin Trudeau, that has also been spent. It has been allocated and will all be spent by the end of the fiscal year on March 31st. One specific little detail here, and this is going to get nerdy, so buckle up. The government is beefing up its contingency fund by drawing down the reserve, and this is a financial maneuver, but it is getting ready to spend a bit more money by increasing its contingency funds.
Okay, we're not going to let your nerdiness off the hook here just yet, because I'm hearing two different things here that need to be a distinction needs to be made. First of all, on the previous thing you just said, quite right, money spent and or allocated. It hasn't all necessarily been spent, but certainly they have designs on it and ought to be spent, they say, by the end of the fiscal year, which is about 6 weeks away. So, okay, good. We've got that thing figured out. Two other things that you said at the end there. The reserves versus the contingency funds. Not the same thing, I guess. What's the difference there?
I mean, it sounds like they're just shuffling paper around, right? But there is a meaningful difference here, and it gives me a chance to get nerdy again. So are you comfortable, Steve?
I am always comfortable when you get nerdy on me, so go for it.
So let's start from like first principles, right? In our system of government, everything starts with the premier and his cabinet asking the legislature for permission to spend money. That is formally what happens when the finance minister gets up and makes his big budget speech every spring. And that is what Peter Bethlen-Falvey will be doing sometime in March. But of course, the government doesn't really know how much money they will need on April 1st of 2021, say, for all of their expenses until March 31st of 2022. So governments have traditionally padded their request with a little bit of wiggle room. It's usually around $1 billion. It was larger this year because of COVID. So when you look at the budget, and you know, I'm talking about the multi-hundred page document that you and I have read multiple budgets over many years now, you see the spending is detailed by every ministry, and then things like debt service are thrown in, and then there's a little bit at the end, which is the reserve, which is basically the government giving itself some wiggle room. In the case of Ontario for the current fiscal year, the one that will end on March 31st, that reserve was $2.5 billion. But the distinction here is that like that's not money sitting in a bank or sitting in an account waiting to be spent. It is basically just an accounting term. That is not money that has either been taxed or borrowed. It just exists as a number on a balance sheet.
So that is the reserve. How is that then different from a contingency fund?
The contingency funds actually are money waiting to be spent. They are just not specifically allocated to a specific ministry, or at least not yet. COVID has obviously meant that governments have a lot of unanticipated spending over the last year, both in terms of how much money they are spending and where it has been needed. And so the government is giving itself flexibility in how it spends that money by putting these very large sums into contingency funds, which aren't tied to a specific ministry or a specific program. So, to put it all together, moving money from the reserve to a contingency fund is government speak for actually spending all or very nearly all of the money they asked for in their budget. Last week, the finance minister said they would draw down the reserve. It had been, I believe, it was programmed for $2.5 billion. They are going to leave just a $500 million reserve to get them to the end of the year. And that is going to beef up the contingency funds to a level of $2.1 billion.
Okay, then. In the world where we then ask, after those dueling news conferences last week, who at the end of the day was actually right, does this description that you've just given us mean that the opposition parties are right, that the government is in fact sitting on billions of dollars?
Not yet, but maybe. It's one of those things where somebody is going to be right by the end of the fiscal year. Either the government will have been telling the truth or the opposition parties will be correct. The point of moving that money into contingency funds, the government says, is to spend it. And even though March 31st is not that far away, they can certainly find ways to spend a few billion more dollars before the end of the fiscal year. Lord knows there are enough people asking for money in Ontario at this point. Anything that they don't spend will go back to the Treasury basically as a reduction in the deficit. And that has to be accounted for. Like they actually do have to say that explicitly and publicly. So sometime after the budget is presented, we will get a clear idea of what happened to all of that contingency money and whether it was, in fact, all spent. As an accounting matter, it might be possible that a few million dollars are left unspent, even if the government does try to spend it all. But we'll get that kind of detail later in the year.
Gotcha. And how about, just finally on this, do we have, I know that you said earlier, March is when the provincial budget will eventually be brought down. I know back in the day, oftentimes, even though the fiscal year was over at the end of March, they sometimes didn't bring the budget down till April or even May. But what Bethlen Falvey has said categorically, March this year?
You might recall this government's first budget did not go over very well with lots of people in the province, including municipalities who were handed a bunch of real big changes to their cash flow after April 1st, like after the fiscal year had already begun. And that became a really big sticking point. They hollered at the government for quite some time because basically they had to throw out budgets that were already in operation, so to speak. So in part because of that, and in part because of a few other reasons, the government has committed that going forward, whenever absolutely possible, they are going to bring in the that year's budget before March 31st. Last week, Minister Bethlen Falvey did reaffirm that the plan is to bring a budget before March 31st. But as you have seen time and time again, the government is being a little bit coy with the timing of the budget specifically.
Okay, let's do one more issue here, and that is, I have a bit of a trivia question for you, John Michael. When is the March break not really the March break?
When it's in April.
There you go. When it happens in April, that's right. Of course, the province announced last week that the March break is not going to happen at its traditional time. Worries about COVID-19 means they are going to push it into April. Doesn't quite have the same ring to it, but it is where we are. Any question in your mind that basically the province, if it wanted to be mindful of fighting COVID-19, had to push the March break off for a month?
You know, it's not super clear to me right now. I guess to give the government's argument, and I think there's something to this. Look, we just came out of a spike in COVID cases that seems to have started because people were traveling and gathering during the Christmas holiday. And March break is not the same as Christmas, but it was too much of a risk to take, and Ontario's hospitals still are overloaded with ICU cases. So having another extended break where people could travel and meet family is just asking for trouble. It's not clear to me, though, whether we, just by moving it to April, we haven't just sort of delayed the pain. Based on the modeling that we saw last week, I don't know. I am not an epidemiologist, but I don't have a really clear picture of how this is supposed to work and what the government hopes to get out of this in the next, let's say, 6 to 8 weeks.
Well, let me freelance a bit here. If the theory is that given how pent up we've all been for the last many weeks, and if March break came, we would all want to get out there and start vacationing and going places and mingling and not physically distancing. It's better for all of that to happen in April when the weather is warmer and the virus will presumably be less virulent than to do it in March. I mean, that's a reasonable conclusion, isn't it?
Yeah, I think weather is going to be one thing. And also, if the vaccination supplies stick to their schedule, we're about to see a really, really pronounced ramp up in vaccination availability in Ontario instead of the, you know, tens of thousands of people getting vaccinated in a week. It should be, you know, substantially more than 100,000 weekly. And that could have a real effect on the general safety of people in Ontario. So it's not like there's nothing to justify the government's decision there. I just, you know, standing here in my podcasting closet as we record this, I don't have a ton of certainty on how this is going to play out.
Well, we've actually only talked about one of two options that the government had: have the break in March, have the break in April. We haven't talked about a third option, which was postpone it altogether, just not have it at all. Any idea why the government didn't choose that option?
Well, I think one obvious factor is that there are implications for the collective bargaining agreements for teachers' unions and the unions of other workers at schools. If you have to call everybody in, and we are, at least at the moment, still talking about people being back in-person schooling for most of Ontario's schools, that could be challenged by teachers' unions as, you know, an increase in their workload, and they might have asked for more compensation to reflect the fact that they were doing more instruction.
And one last question on this: how confident is the province that the curve will continue to be flattened if, in fact, March break is postponed until April?
Well, the curves that we saw in that modeling briefing, some of them just keep rebounding in late March, and those cases actually start coming back up again. The more optimistic projections show the caseload staying flat, but I don't know, Steve, how often have the most optimistic projections turned out to be the right ones here in Ontario lately?
Yeah, unfortunately, it seems better to be a pessimist and a realist as opposed to an optimist and be wrong. But hope springs eternal, right?
Hope springs eternal.
There we go. Okay, before we get to our quotes of the week, send us an email, if you would. Let us know what you liked or what you didn't like about our program, and just help make our podcast a little bit better.
You can reach us via email at onpolitics@tvo.org.
Here's some feedback we received last week from someone on Twitter who wrote, "You asked for feedback on today's On Poly podcast, so here goes. I am impressed with your factual reporting, lack of sensationalism, and dose of Ontario political history. Keep it up. Room for improvement, including marginalized voices more often." That is some excellent advice, and we are grateful for it.
For my quote of the week, I am going to turn once again to Government House Leader Paul Calandra, who, when I spoke with him last week, spoke a bit about how proud he is of the work that all MPPs from both, you know, government and opposition benches did over the last year through the pandemic.
And I've said this a million times in the House, and I constantly repeat it because it's very important. The opposition allowed us to move very quickly. They cooperated with us very effectively throughout the early stages of the pandemic. But at no time did they ever, you know, roll over and not do what they have to do, and that's to hold the government accountable. They did a very good job throughout it. They often had pieces of legislation during that time period changed. but ultimately allowed us to move quickly.
That's Government House Leader Paul Calandra, who spoke with me last week.
Now, I don't want to be predictable, so I'm not going to pick for my quote of the week Doug Ford waxing on about how much he likes the new egg burger at Timmy's or whatever the heck he was talking about, or even how Brendan Shanahan is tight as the skin on a grape. No, I'm going to go in a different direction, but I am sort of staying with Shanahan. I'm going to talk about hockey here. Did you hear the story about the NHL players being allowed to go out to restaurants and eat in restaurants while the rest of us can't? Well, that did cause a bit of a foo-for-all last week, but Ontario's Chief Medical Officer of Health, David Williams, said it's all kosher.
The rules with the NHL are very much strict with their protocols, with their frequent testing, their isolation of their players to the extent, and especially very tight transport within Canada. They do not leave the country, so they're staying in the province during this whole, or in the country for this whole time. There are some players, of course, this is not their home, and require some place to have some eating and food facilities, and the NHL has procured that in a tight level of restriction and control. So that's all part of their bubble, if you may use that term, which they have strictly laid out in their protocol, and so far, as far as I'm concerned, they've been adhering to it.
That's Dr. David Williams on why NHLers can eat in at restaurants, even if the rest of us can't.
Also, excellent use of the word foo-for-all there, Steve.
It meets the McGrathian standard, did it?
Absolutely.
Good stuff. Well, that was the Wayne Gretzky episode of the On Poly podcast. JMM, do you have any idea what I'm referring to there?
It's the 99th episode of the podcast. Hey, I got this one. I understood that reference.
I am deeply impressed. I am deeply impressed. He knows Wayne. He didn't know who Brendan Shanahan was, but he did know Wayne Gretzky wore number 99. I like that. Yes, that was our 99th episode, so we've got something special coming your way next week for our 100th episode. Just a little celebration, so be sure to check that one out. This episode was produced by Katie O'Connor, with editing from Matthew O'Mara, production support from Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Halliwell. JMM, you know I like to sign off by quoting my dad's famous expression every week, but I have to note, the Minister of Finance, Peter Bethlen-Falvey, almost, sorta, kinda did the same thing at the end of his press conference last week. Listen to the minister.
Thanks, everyone, and have a great day, and stay safe. Test negative and stay positive.
Okay, he reversed the order, so I guess that's not a copyright infringement. We'll let him get away with it. But I'm going to do it for real now, and that is, as you know, JMM, as my dad likes to say, stay positive, test negative.
Stay safe, Steve.